Okay, so, well, I gave my talk a very general title, so I could put in it whatever I wanted. But in fact, it will be a kind of overview of a joint project that with Matthias Aschenbrenner and Joris van der Hoeven. Matthias and I started this more than 10 years ago, and then later we joined up with Joris. And the goal here is really to understand the model theory of a certain differential field, namely the order differential field T of trend series. Now, what does this mean? And what is T anyway? So, first of all, T is a very big field of series. Its elements are, you think of them as series, and it, in particular, it contains the field of Lorentz series, this field of Lorentz series in 1 over x over the real numbers. But it's much bigger. For example, while this contains just series in powers of x, the elements of the field of trend series also contain exponentials and logarithms and so on. And you write such a series just as you usually do. You start on the left with the big terms, and then the smaller terms, smaller, smaller. Here you have a constant term. Here you have the infinitesimal terms, right? So this part of the series here is the infinite part. Then there you have the constant term, and there you have the infinitesimal part. And using Joris's notation, this is also written this way. F is, this symbol here means you take the infinite part of the series. This is the constant term. That's just the real number. And this is the infinitesimal part. Okay? Now, this is for various reasons an interesting differential, or the differential field. It comes up naturally. Both in model theory, in connection with studying the theory of the real exponential fields, and in this connection it was introduced by Dan and Walter. It also comes up naturally in connection with Dirac's problem, and Eckhall has a lot of interesting things to say about how this field of trend series and uses it in his work. So I want to say a bit more for those who haven't seen this field before. Ah, let me see if this works. Right. I want to say a bit more. Yeah, in the field of Lorentz series, for example, you cannot, in general, take the exponential of a Lorentz series. Well, you can take the exponential of an infinitesimal Lorentz series, for example, or even of a finite Lorentz series. For example, the exponential of 1 plus 1 over x is simply obtained by using the Taylor expansion. But you cannot take the exponential of a Lorentz series with an infinite part. I mean, you are forced to go out of the Lorentz series. That's why this thing is introduced. Let me see. I had to put this now. Right. Oh wait. Now. I'm not. I wanted to keep that. Wait. What happened now? Oh, no. Let me see what I did. I wanted to keep this.
Put your first slide on. Put your first slide on.
Yes.
Put it in.
Where?
No, it's right here.
Oh, okay. Right. Yes.
Okay.
Ah.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. So that's what I'll try to do. Every time I finish a slide, I'll put it there. So this is our new slide. Well, this field of trend series has natural operations of exponentiation, differentiation, and composition. composition means just substituting, if you have two series fx and gx, you just substitute gx for x. But you can only do that if g is bigger than r. I mean, there is a natural ordering on the trend series. By just looking at the leading term and looking at the coefficient there, if that is positive, then your series is positive. For example, if you have your series written like, for example, this series, if you want to exponentiate it, you first take the exponential of the constant term, which is just a real number, which is e to the 3 in this case. Then you take the formal exponent, you take a formal monomial exp of the infinite part. You simply consider the exp of this infinite part as a new monomial, and then you multiply it by the exponential of the infinitesimal part, which you work out just as with the Taylor expansion of exp, right? And so if you write it all out and collect terms together, you will get again some series. So these series, of course, have support not just the natural numbers or the integers, but in general they are ordered like an ordinal, a countable ordinal. And so, I should also say that this T admits the inverse operations to these basic ones, namely the inverse of exp is log, and since you can show that the exponentials of the trend series are all the positive trend series, so you can always take the log of a positive series. Every element is the derivative. The differentiation is basically defined inductively and term-wise. So here you just take the derivatives term by term. And so every element actually can be integrated. And this says that the constants, that means the element with derivative zero, are exactly the real numbers. Okay, and composition also have a sort of inverse, namely for every f bigger than r, there is a unique g such that if you compose f with g and g with f, you get just the identity back. Right, now, what is, for example, interesting about this from the point of view of model theory or O-minimality is that this gives us natural models of the real field with non-standard models of the real field with exponentiation. So you get the real field with exponentiation is an elementary substructure of the field of trend series as an exponential field. And even you can also put analytic structure on the trend series field, and then this still remains true. So there is a lot of O-minimal structure on the reals that is also that is inherited by the field of trend series. But what we are actually going to be interested in is the field of trend series not as an O-minimal field, but as a differential field. I mean, the derivation on T does not come from the reals. Well, you could say it comes from Hardy fields on if you take, for example, the Hardy fields of Rexp, then it has a natural embedding, a canonical one, into the field of trend series. And of course, the Hardy fields, and this is compatible also with the derivation. And same thing with here. So, right. Okay, so now what do I do again? I remove this. Okay. So now, from now on, I'm just going to consider T as a differential field. And so, as I already said, the constants of these differential fields are exactly the reals, and this is, of course, definable in the field of trend series. So here is an obvious question that any model theorist would ask. Is the set of integers definable in T? Well, this would be a kind of a disaster. It would certainly destroy what we want to do. I mean, it's sort of the end of the story if that happens. So we hope that the answer is no. But one, as a note of caution, Z actually is definable in the differential subfields, which consist of purely exponential series. So this, when you take these trend series, there's nothing there. Let me see. What did I do wrong here? I guess I forgot what to do. Let's continue. So the purely exponential series are exactly the series where there are no logarithms involved. So for the model theory of our trend series field to become nice, the logarithms are really very essential. At least that's what we hope. Anyway, what we are hoping for is results like that T is model complete. And remember, when I say T, I really mean it as a differential field. And also that T is asymptotically or minimal. Okay. So, right. So I have to explain what this means for those who are not so familiar with those terms. So one, model completeness, means a kind of theorem of the complement, or more. It's actually one is a bit more precise than a theorem of the complement, but and what I mean by that is that for any differential polynomial P over T in n plus n variables, if you take the complement in T to the m of the set of points in T to the m where the polynomial vanishes for some point B in T to the n, then the complement is also again of the same form. Yeah. So if you take a set like that and you take its complement, then the complement is again of the form the set of all A where QAC is zero for some C in T to the n prime, and for some differential polynomial Q in m plus n prime variables. So that's what roughly speaking model completeness means. And two means this asymptotically or minimal. It's also called, well, for fields it's really equivalent to weakly to locally or minimal, but I like this formulation. So this asymptotically or minimal means that for every definable subset of X of T, there is an A such that either all elements in the series, in the trend series field bigger than A are in X, or all of them are out of X. And we know this is true for example, for quantifier-free definable sets. So let's see. I know I have to do this first, right? Yeah. And now, what is the best evidence that we have for 1 and 2? Well, I think it is really the detailed analysis by Joris in his book on trend series and real differential algebra. It's not a very easy book, I think, but it's very, very worth studying. And he studied carefully the zero set in T of any given differential polynomial in one variable over T. And in particular, he obtained this nice intermediate value theorem, namely that given any differential polynomial over T in one variable, and any A and B in T, such that A is less than B and PA less than 0 less than PB, there is an intermediate value in this interval where the differential polynomial vanishes. So here I'm already fixing some notation. K with these, braces? Or curly brackets. Y is the ring of differential polynomials in one indeterminate Y over the differential field K. So it's really a polynomial, ordinary polynomials in y, y prime, y double prime, etc. But when you substitute in a differential polynomial like that an element y, that means that when you view it as a polynomial in y, y prime, y double prime, you substitute little y for capital Y, and then little y prime, the derivative of little y, for y capital Y prime, and the second derivative of little y for y double prime, etc. So, yeah, so this is... right. Now I have to... I think I get the hang of it now. Good. So now, Abram Robinson has taught us basically how to attack problems of this sort in a somewhat indirect but nevertheless very illuminating way. And he's taught us what is model theoretically significant about model completeness and also algebraically, and given us tools to establish it in various ways. So along these lines, we propose to establish one, the model completeness. Remember, one is the model completeness of T. We hope to establish it as follows. We introduce a certain class of H-fields, what we call H-fields. I'm going to define this in the next transparency. They are going to be ordered differential fields whose ordering and derivation interact roughly as in T. And then next, find a set sigma of elementary properties of T. Elementary properties means properties that can be expressed in the language, in the first order language of order differential fields. So find such a set with the such that the H fields that satisfy these properties are exactly the so-called existentially closed H fields. So I have to explain what H fields are, and I have to explain now what I mean by existentially closed H fields. I hope the rest is clear. Yeah. So I'm going to first say what H fields are. so they just incorporate the most elementary facts about order differential fields, where the ordering and the derivation behave a bit like in the field of trend series. So so an H field is an ordered differential field K with constant field C, that means the set of elements in K where the derivative is zero, such that the following three conditions are satisfied. First of all, if you take the convex hull of C in K, then this consists of the sums of elements in C and elements in the maximal ideal of this convex hull. You see, this convex hull is automatically a valuation ring in K, and so the maximal ideal of it has a maximal ideal whose elements are actually the things that are infinitesimal compared to C, the things that are consisting of zero, and those elements of K that are less in absolute value than every positive element of C. So you can easily see that this is true in the field of trend series. Here the element of O consists of the elements that whose infinite part is zero, and so it consists just of a constant term, which is this contribution, plus an infinitesimal part. Secondly, if an element is bigger than all constants, then its derivative must be positive. So this reflects the fact that, for example, in a Hardy field, if an element goes to infinity, then its derivative must be ultimately positive. And finally, I assume more for convenience. It's not really essential, but I assume that the derivative maps the infinitesimals into the infinitesimal. The derivative of an infinitesimal is an infinitesimal. Right, so the examples are Hardy fields and T, and of course, and then I have to say what I mean by existentially closed, which is what I define, which I mentioned here. An H field K is said to be existentially closed if for every differential polynomial in several variables, such that you can solve this equation in an 8-field extension of K, then you can already solve it in K itself. So this is all completely standard in model theory, so I apologize for those people who have heard this a million times, but I'm giving it for the others, so the talk. So later on, only at the end, will I mention a few things that are less standard. I have to keep this here, right? And then I have to, okay, so right. So especially by the work of Joris, we know very many elementary properties of this field of trend theories, of this differential field, I should say, of trend theories. And part of our program must be to show that every 8 field can be extended to one that has these same elementary properties. I mean, it's a general fact that every 8 field can be extended to an existentially closed 8 field, and if we want to, and since we want to show that the existentially closed 8 fields are exactly like T as far as their elementary properties is concerned, this in particular involves showing that every 8 field can be extended to one that has the same elementary properties. Right? So what we do, we try to find these elementary properties. We take them as our set of axioms sigma, and then we want to show that every model of sigma is actually existentially closed. Right, so here is a very simple example of an elementary property of T, which is maybe all too simple, but as a field, this doesn't involve the derivation, T is real closed. So the counterpart of this fact on the level of 8 fields should be that the real closure of an 8 field is an 8 field. And that's true. I mean, it's not so, it actually requires a little bit of work, but it's not hard. another example, which is still relatively simple, namely, T is Liouville closed. This means it's not only real closed, but also you can solve any linear differential equation of order 1. Yeah, if you have AY prime plus BY plus C with A, B, and C in the field T, you can always find a solution. And likewise, on the level of, on the 8 field level, this should mean that any 8 field can be extended to a Liouville closed 8 field. And again, this is true. But now there is actually already an interesting phenomenon that you cannot see just by staying inside T, namely the phenomenon that it can happen that an 8 field has up to K isomorphism to Liouville closures. Of course, what I mean by a Liouville closure is a Liouville closed 8 field extension which can be obtained by just taking repeated iteratively real closures and by adjoining solutions of equations like that. So it turns out that an 8 field can have up to isomorphism 2 Liouville closures. It can have, in many cases it has only one, but it, there are situations where there are exactly 2. And so this is related to the fact that model theorists will recognize that this would that this prevents the field of trend theories to from having a quantifier elimination in the language of ordered value differential fields. Which means that if we had quantifier elimination in a nice simple language like that, then in some sense model completeness is too weak to aim for. But since we can't have quantifier elimination because of this phenomenon, model completeness seems our best bet at this point. Right, so Okay, so now we are going to restrict, since every H field can be extended unique, its real closure is also an H field. So I'm going to restrict my attention now to real closed H fields. There is no loss of generality in that. And I have to introduce some notation to continue my talk. So the derivative of an element in an H field I will denote by either A prime or delta A. But it turns out it's also useful to consider the logarithmic derivative of a non-zero element. So, and this is indicated by A with a dagger. Then C will usually denote the constant field, and O will usually denote the convex hull of the constant field in K. And so, as I already mentioned, this is always a valuation ring. This valuation turns out to be, in some sense, more important than the ordering. The ordering comes in just in our arguments not so often, but the valuation is the dominating thing here. Now this valuation has a nice property that if two elements A and B have the same valuation, then their derivatives also have the same valuation. Well, provided that this valuation is not zero. So in other words, if A and B are not units in the valuation ring. So what this means is, in particular, that the derivation induces also a function on the value group, right? You can define the derivation of an element of the value of VA to be simply V of delta A. And this definition is justified because of this here. And I'm going to denote this derivation, this function that delta induces on the value group, I'm simply going to denote it also by delta, or maybe delta V, to indicate that it has to do with V as well. But it's not everywhere defined, it's only defined on gamma minus zero. And likewise, of course, the logarithmic derivative operation on K induces also a corresponding operation on the value group in the same way. After all, the valuation of A dagger is simply the valuation of A prime minus the valuation of A. So, and these functions on gamma have some very useful properties. For example, the derivation induces on gamma a strictly increasing function, and there are two possibilities. Either it's surjective, or it's surjective except for one point. There's only one point missing in the image. So this case we often refer to as that you have asymptotic integration. It basically means that every element in the field has an antiderivative which is very close to it. So you can almost integrate. Good. Ah, yes, I think my slide here, it's sort of, this didn't work very well. Let me see if I can copy where do I have one? Let me see if I can. Yeah, I was trying to draw here the graph of the logarithmic. This is the graph of the logarithmic derivative. Yeah, and so graph of, let's say, gamma of the induced function on the function induced on gamma by the logarithmic derivative function. And here is the graph of the derivative.
No, maybe you can just spell the special.
That is an element that falls in this gap here between. Yeah, if there is an element like that, then it is going to be exactly in this gap here between that I just indicated. I mean, there might not be anything there, but this is sort of the eye of the storm where a lot happens. Maybe I should also say, in this picture, if you think of this as the picture of corresponding to the field of trend series, then here you have the valuation of X, and here you have some, well, here you have the valuation of e to the X. Here you have, of course, 1 over x, the valuation of 1 over x. Here you have log x, the valuation of log x. This is the valuation of e to the x, the valuation of 1 over x. And so on. If you take higher and higher iterates of the log, you get closer and closer to the y-axis. All right. Good. This picture is for at least for Matthias and me very helpful. We visualize it all the time when we are working because it's extremely systematic. Schematic. I mean, it cannot indicate a lot of things, but. Still, this picture is very useful for us. Okay, so I want to mention a few things about these functions that are induced on the value group. Of course, delta gamma is gamma plus gamma dagger, and it's often useful to view this induced function as the perturbation of the identity by the function gamma goes to gamma dagger, because this last function varies very, very slowly. You see here, you can't really see that, but look, this is very close to the at least for large values of gamma, this is close to the identity function, while this is extremely slowly varying, but you can't really indicate that in the picture. So now Rosenlicht already realized that there's something interesting going on here, and he called the ordered abelian group gamma. He did this in connection with Hardy fields. The ordered abelian group gamma, equipped with this logarithmic derivative map on gamma, he called it the asymptotic couple of K. And there are this logarithmic derivative map, so to say, on the level of the value group has some nice basic elementary properties. For example, it turns out to be a valuation on gamma in this sense. And also, as you can see in this picture, all the derivatives of infinitesimal elements have a bigger valuation than the valuations of all the logarithmic derivatives of infinitesimal elements. So the infinitesimal elements, their valuations lie here on the positive axis, right? So you see that all these are below all these. So that is the second property. This actually is a reflection of the L'Hopital's rule. And the other thing that is indicated here is that that this function is decreasing, well, in the weak sense. And that is also indicated here. That is this law. So now, one thing that we can say, and that Matthias and I worked this out more than 10 years ago, namely that the model theory of these asymptotic couples is at least is very well understood. The model theory of these asymptotic couples is fairly well understood. For example, the existentially closed asymptotic couples are exactly those that satisfy these two properties, namely that delta is surjective, that the set of logarithmic derivatives or the valuations of logarithmic derivatives is closed downwards, as actually is the case in the picture. In particular, these existentially closed asymptotics couples are the models of a complete theory which admits quantifier elimination in a very natural language, namely basically the language of asymptotic couples, order to be in groups together with this Dagger function, except that you have to add also a predicate for this set. Otherwise you don't get quantifier elimination. For example, the asymptotic couple of the field of Strand series and of any Liouville closed H field for that matter is existentially closed. Now, arbitrary asymptotic couples, not necessarily asymptotic, not necessarily existentially closed, they fall into three disjoint classes, and this trichotomy is rather crucial to for us. First, it can happen that there is this element gamma that lies between all the derivative valuations of logarithmic derivatives of infinitesimals and valuations of derivatives of infinitesimals. That can happen for only one gamma, and if it exists, we call it the gap. It can also happen that this set has a maximum, and finally, it can happen that delta is surjective. That is this asymptotic integrability condition, which is, so for example, for the existentially closed asymptotic couples fall under three. Right. So now, yes. So now, case one is where you have this gap, is not so easy to realize. It cannot occur, for example, in eight subfields of T. It can also not occur in, let's say, Hardy fields of finite rank. You have to go to pretty big Hardy fields for it to be, or to eight extensions of T. Encounter a situation where this happens. It does happen in eight subfields of elementary extensions of T. So, in other words, for the model theory of T, you cannot this case one cannot be avoided. You have to study it, and it is a kind of a fork in the road. You have this gap here, and if you you can fill the gap, and you can either fill it with the derivative of an infinitesimal or with the derivative of an infinitely large element, but you cannot do both. One nice thing, though, is, okay, so here you have your H field K, and suppose you are considering, you are making extensions, let's say differentially algebraic extensions, right? So at some point at some point it's possible that you obtain, although K might not have a gap, it might happen that L has a gap. But once you have a gap, you can go into two directions. Here you fill the gap by the derivative of an infinitesimal, and here you fill the gap by the derivative of an infinitely large element. And the nice thing is that this gap then does not, once you have crossed this gap, it doesn't reoccur anymore. The bad thing that could happen if you go in this direction, that there will again be a gap. But fortunately, this doesn't happen. So once you have reached the gap, then once you get over it, you will not encounter it anymore, as long as you stay within differentially, if you just look at differentially algebraic extensions. So So once we are in case two, if you fill the gap, you land in case two. And once you are in case two, you cannot get back in case one in a differentially algebraic extension. So that gives some consolation for this, you know, this gap phenomenon is annoying, but at least it's not, it could have been worse. So once we are in case two, we cannot get, I already said that. So we are most comfortable with two. Once you are in case two, you can do a lot of constructions and extension procedures that are hard to do when otherwise. Okay, so typically, and how about case three, which include all the existentially, all the Liouville closed H fields? Well, typically these H fields are that satisfy three are obtained as directed unions of H subfields satisfying two. At least that it's not always the case, but that is what usually happens. Right. Okay. So now. Right. So here is another reason why we like case two. For example, if you are in case two, then the Liouville closure of K satisfies three. Actually, I already said that, and it is an inductive union of subfields, eight subfields that satisfy two. And if K satisfies condition two, which I guess it's not there anymore, but then we have systematic ways of solving any linear differential equation in suitable eight-field extensions. So, and also in their algebraic closure. Yeah, I should say I'm talking all the time about eight-fields, but in practice you have to go often to extensions of it that are not eight-fields anymore, but still preserve many of their properties. For example, algebraic closure of H fields. And sometimes you also want to coarsen the valuation when you also lose some properties, but a lot still goes through. So you can even construct its Picard-Vaisseau extension, but there are still some issues of uniqueness to be settled. And here is a question that arose some years ago, I think, but we still haven't answered it. Although I guess we are sure that the answer should be yes. If it's not, then we are in big trouble. Can every H field be extended to one that satisfies two? It really should be so, otherwise our project will destruct, I'm afraid. But I'm confident that at least we should be able to answer this sooner or later. Anyway, if so, it would immediately tell us a lot about existentially closed eight fields, right? Because once you embed an eight field into one that satisfies two, you have a lot of extension procedures that you can do that tell you what happens in existentially closed eight fields. All right. Okay. So this is, I've now sort of told the state of affairs of a few years ago, and I can now finally mention a few things that we did largely here at the Fields Institute, by roughly speaking by studying carefully what Joris did in his book on the field of trend series and trying to adapt some of his work to more general eight fields. And I mean, this is part of our program. We have to do that in order to ultimately answer the questions we are interested in. Right? So here is this important notion of the Newton polynomial. that Joris introduced in the for the field of trend series. If you have a differential polynomial P, which is not zero, then you can write it in, well, you can divide by a coefficient of it of lowest possible valuation and F, and then you write, P becomes equal to F times a differential polynomial with constant coefficients plus the remainder term R, right? So D sub P here is a differential polynomial with constant coefficients. That's what we gain here, and this F has the same valuation as the minimum valuation of the coefficients, right? VP is by definition the minimum valuation of the coefficients of P. So and this R is much smaller. The valuation, the coefficients of R are much smaller than F. And that means it has V of R is bigger than this. So this determines dP uniquely up to a factor, up to a unit factor. That means an element up to a factor with valuation zero. And so this dP is called the dominant part of P, and makes kind of sense that this is an important object. For example, by Hensel's lemma, since we are assuming that K is real closed, if you can factor dP into coprime factors, then this factorization will lift to a factorization of P. Although we haven't really used this, but this is simply something to observe. But this is, it turns out that this new dominant part is not very useful. But I have to mention it, because what is really useful is called the Newton polynomial. And and this is obtained by bringing in an extra operation. Okay, but this actually works only if we you can only do this if K satisfies. Well, actually, no. It really does make sense also for two. But anyway, let's assume that K satisfies three. Then something very interesting happens. Remember, 3 is the case where you have asymptotic integration, and then the following happens. You can rewrite P in terms of the of another derivation. You multiply the derivation by 1 over phi, where the valuation of phi is less than than this set in the value group. Now, what is this? So if you do that, you get the dominant part of the, let's say, modified differential polynomial. And it will still be a differential polynomial over the same constant field. But it will now vary with phi. And as this valuation of phi increases, this dominant part will eventually settle down to a fixed differential polynomial. It will not change anymore. And this is called the Newton polynomial. So this will be a differential polynomial with constant coefficients. And Joris proved that when K is the field of trend series, this Newton polynomial has a very special form. Namely, it's simply a polynomial, an ordinary polynomial in Y times the power of Y prime. In other words, the higher derivatives, Y double, etc., don't show up anymore. And the first derivative shows up just like a power multiplied by an ordinary polynomial. So this is a very important invariant from which you can read off a lot about the behavior of P near the constant field. So one thing that we did is to show that this fact generalizes to a large class of H fields, namely, this fact, of course, is also in the setting of arbitrary H fields satisfying 3, but this really important fact is not always true. in this setting. But if you assume that K is Lie view closed and also an inductive union of eight subfields satisfying two, then it is again of this special form. Yeah, and then the unfortunate thing is that there is an example of a Lie view closed eight field and a differential polynomial whose Newton polynomial does not have this special form. Right, so, and yeah, so you see extra complications show up that are annoying, but it also keeps us busy. So, okay, so now my final transparency is something that we discussed a lot over the last week. Namely, another thing that Joris did in the case of trend series, he observed that that for the case of the field of trend series, if the Newton polynomial P of a differential polynomial P vanishes at zero, then this must also be true for the Newton polynomial of any linear combination of P and P prime. Yeah, here the coefficient A's and B's are also differential polynomials. In fact, this is even true if you take a linear combination of P, P prime, P double, etc. And in the case of trend series, yeah, there is a certain way to see it, which does not extend to yet to that situation. So, but we really want this to be true for every eighth field that satisfies three. I think we have convinced ourselves, or at least Joris has convinced us, that if this is not true, then we are in big trouble. So this really should be, this is a bottleneck that we have to get through in order to make real progress. But if we do, if we are able to establish this, and this looks like the kind of fact that it's, well, what shall I say, it is not a formal. It looked like that it should be true on formal grounds in some sense, but we don't yet see those grounds. Anyway, if it is true, then every K that has asymptotic integration has an immediate spherically complete eight-field extension, and it is very likely to be unique up to isomorphism. This requires, we have to verify some things, but I believe that this is going to be true. And this would be nice for various reasons. For example, it would also answer the earlier question, can every eight field be embedded into one that satisfies two? If you can answer this question, then it turns out that the spherically complete eight field satisfying three, we already know from a long time ago that those can be embedded. There is you can do a one-step extension that satisfies two. Or is it a three-step? No, it's a two-step extension. You can adjoin an anti-logarithmic derivative, and then you have to do one extra step, and you get an eighth field that satisfies two. Right. Yeah. Okay. Actually, when I say every eighth field extends to one satisfying two, I could also, equivalently, every eighth field extends to one satisfying one. It turns out that this is equivalent. Right. So, you see, I don't know how far we are. I have the feeling that we have to still do a lot, but yours is perhaps more optimistic about that. But at least this is a question that we should be able to answer, and that will give access to a lot of other things. Okay, I'll stop here.